Okay, let's wind up the rubber bands and get started. We are, at this point, an hour behind schedule. Michael and I have been talking about it. I think the most effective approach, we got to figure out who to throw off the lifeboat here. And I think what we will do is to work past or take off the IAS 7 discussion. And we'll circle back to it depending on what our time availability is. Either we'll put it inserted at the end of this meeting or at next meeting, depending on how things develop. But as Laurence points out, we had a pretty ambitious agenda already.
Well, we did take off paper 20, so that's why I didn't
But it doesn't buy us an hour, which is what we had scheduled. So, Kaz, paper number 9.
So this is agenda paper 9. This issue is about the interpretation and application of paragraph 93 of IS 19. That paragraph refers to the accounting for employee contributions that are set out in the formal terms of a defined benefit plan. The Interpretations Committee discussed this issue twice in September and November. In this paper, we made an analysis of whether certain types of employee contributions to a defined benefit plan reduce short-term employee benefits costs instead of reducing post-employment benefit costs. In the staff's view, employee contributions are classified as a reduction in short-term employee benefits if the contributions are linked solely to the employee's service rendered in the same period, and also the contributions are expected to be settled within 12 months. If we take this approach, employee contributions will be accounted for as either as a reduction in short-term benefits or as post-employment benefits. If the contributions are accounted for as post-employment benefits, the contributions will be attributed to periods of service as a negative benefit in accordance with paragraph 93, unless they reduce remeasurement of the net defined benefit liability. We think such distinction better reflects the underlying economics of employee contributions. We recommend that the committee should provide implementation guidance, and that the guidance should include the analysis in this paper, as well as some specific examples of attributing employee contributions to periods of service as a negative benefit. So does the committee agree with my analysis and the recommendation?
Laurence?
I agree with the direction, but I was wondering whether this paper doesn't put too much emphasis on the classification issue of those employee contributions, and perhaps a simpler approach would rather be maybe the best would be to rationalize an approach where we would focus on whether the employees are taking risks.
Excuse me, Laurence, I didn't pick.
Where the employees are assessing whether the employees are taking risks. When the employees, when there is no risk retained by the employees, then we would see it as a reduction of the cost of the plan that is a negative benefit. Because in my view, it's the nature of this is really a reduction of the cost of the plan, those employees' contributions. So for me, it seems simpler to look at whether it's just an ongoing reduction of the plan or whether there is something other that is variable where paragraph 93 of IS 19 would apply. So what I'm suggesting is rather putting the focus, saying that in most of the cases it would just be an ongoing reduction of the cost of the plan, so a negative benefit. But where we identify that employees' contributions bear some element of risk sharing from the employee's side, then paragraph 93 applies. And I think that rather than, you know, going into this analysis of whether the short-term employee benefits, and I think this would be easier to understand. It would lead to about the same outcome, I think.
Yep.
And
I don't think that would be inconsistent with what we're, the staff is suggesting in the paper. Perhaps it's a different way of getting there.
Yeah.
I think the paper puts more emphasis on the existing definitions of, you know, short-term benefit and post-employment benefit, and that distinction isn't based on the risks. It's based on when the payments occur and the relationship to the service. But I think you'd probably get to the same place, because if there is some element of risk sharing, then that would suggest that a payment would relate to elements other than the current service.
And I would find it's more intuitive, more easier to explain.
Kaz?
Yes. Well, I also agree with the staff recommendation, basically. I really appreciate we agree to support to the preparers, not to do this complicated calculation for basically the simple percentage, fixed percentage reduction of the salary or contribution. So I think in order to resolve this, I think the staff proposal is very effective. But the only concern I have is looking at the example one and two. One is a reduction of salary. Two is a reduction of service cost. I can understand this simple example, but in reality, it may be more complicated. I think maybe the employer, as Scott mentioned last time, that decide to offer the, instead of 3% raise of salary, 2% of contribution. So that case, it apply to this, but it may not be clear. So I don't want to cause unintended consequences or unnecessary declassification from the salary or service cost. Understanding this notion, ideas, and then just keep it as long as it's a short-term benefit, and then go into the discussion of the other than short-term benefit is going to the defined contribution. So that kind of separation may need to make it more, I was wondering if we can do something better approach. Well, approach itself is okay, but I just need to tweak it to help prepare us to not to make it more complicated.
I think you just got more than a tweak. There, let me ask your question differently. Is it automatic? The example that you gave in the paper was a low percentage for the first 10 years, and then it bumped up a couple of percentage points from year 10 forward. And you said in the paper, this means that it cannot be a short-term benefit. Is that self-evident to everybody? Is there any dissent about around that?
As I went through this paper, I'm like, so if it was 4 and then it goes to 6, how does that, I get what you're trying to make as the argument, but this didn't tell me that that in fact was the case. So if I have a different percentage contribution because of years of service or particular age, how does that demonstrate to me that there's a future, a future or post-employment, that it's not for this immediate term?
Let's let the staff answer that question.
Well, I guess it comes down to which attribution is probably the best representative of the underlying economics for that particular, contribution formula. I think there are cases where it's quite clear. For instance, I think we can probably all agree that it's a flat percentage, then attributing that, you know, in accordance with the with salary would be okay. However, if the contribution happens at the end, when the benefit is paid, similar to some of the medical benefits, then the attribution to periods of service on a straight line basis would also be appropriate. However, there is a point somewhere in between that spectrum where it gets a bit grey, and unfortunately, judgment will have to be applied. I don't think there can be a kind of bright line where we can say definitively one is better than the other. The problem arises because under IS 19 there is a distinction between these benefits, and there's two different classifications, and the timing of recognition is different under both of them. If there was just one classification of benefits, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have this problem. So to respond to your question, is there any particular features that would give rise to the accounting under 93, as opposed to there are? In some cases, it's going to be more evident than in others. But being completely definitive on that is quite difficult, I think, especially considering how IS 19 deals with unvested benefits.
Did you think the percentage was higher when you had less service and lower when you had more service? What would you think about that?
So
let's say the reverse. So if it was 6 and 4.
Well, then you'd have the same problem, because the contributions that you're paying for up front should be attributed forward, because they'll be funding the future service as well. So I think the same problem would occur. I don't think that...
The only difference being that it'd be front-end loaded,
exactly,
rather than back-end
loaded.
I find that more compelling.
Scott?
You'd probably get to the same outcome because of the attribution requirements under paragraph 93, but that's a different question. Yeah.
Well, I kind of like the proposal in my gut. It feels nice. I think I can actually tell the line that the staff is drawing, which is, in my head, it was basically, if the current year's contribution depends upon things that happened in other than the current year, then you have to use the attribution, paragraph 93, and if it doesn't, then you don't. You use short-term benefits. I kind of like the answer. I think it gives a simple answer for simple plans and a more complicated answer for more complicated plans. That doesn't bother me. I am a little bothered, though, by the fact that, I don't know how to say this, we seem to have played with the words in the standard and tried to force them to fit our worldview in order to get to this answer. Or to put it more simply, I cannot believe that when they wrote this, the boards were thinking some employee contributions to defined benefit plans will be accounted for as negative benefits and others won't be. I mean, I maybe the board members, you know, can chime in here, but reading the standard, reading the basis for conclusions, I can't imagine that the boards were actually thinking some would just be some employee contributions to defined benefit plans would nonetheless be considered short-term benefits. I can't imagine that's what they meant. Even though I like the way we've twisted the words to make it say that, because I like the answer, I'm just troubled by the fact that we seem to be finding new meaning in the standard.
John, and then we'll go to the phones, and then board members will have the opportunity to defend their honor.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of an echo of Scott's comments. I mean, I like the direction. I think I have two concerns. One, the robustness of the distinction, and is it solely based upon fixed percentage versus variable percentages?
I think that was my question.
Contributions. I mean, that's the one example you've given, but I can think of myriad other fact patterns. And is it, can we create a robust line? And the second issue is I'm not sure implementation guidance gets you there because I don't read it in paragraph 93. So similar to Scott, I think we're coming up with a solution that I don't see in the standard, even though it's one that I would like to get to.
On the phones, Luca.
Yes, I agree with the way we are going, and so I appreciate a lot the effort made in order to solve this issue. Speaking with the actuarial that is working with us, he underlined to me that in general, what is the present practice for the application is in generally view B rather than view A, because it's also more pragmatic and more easy to perform from the perspective of the actuarials that are to make the evaluation. My only doubt is if it's enough to prepare something in the form of implementation guidance, or on the contrary, if we are speaking something more relevant that have to be clarified throughout some amendments of AAS 19. That's the only question that I have in mind is if it's the instrument that we are speaking about, so an implementation guidance, is the most appropriate tool that we have in our pocket to better clarify which are what we are intending for the application and for the resolution of this issue.
Thank you, Luca. Peggy?
Excuse me. I would agree with those sentiments from Luca, as well as some of the others.
Balaam?
I think it's our thinking direction is moving in the right direction. But a simpler suggested approach could be better by focusing on the contributions only as a reduction in short-term employees' benefits, unless they are made specifically in connection with the deficit arising from past service. But what's the potential implication for due process if the committee decides to suggest some implementation guidance, perhaps better judge to interpret or amend the standards?
Guido?
At the same question that Phelong had, on the due process for implementation guidance, have the same reservations that others had. Looking at the wording of the standard, it says if it's linked to service, you have to apply 93, and then we say in implementation guidance. But if it's solely linked to service, then it's not 93. So I'm more sympathetic, and I understand that is something that cannot be done by interpretation, but to look at it on a board level, and maybe the board could reconsider the decision they made in IS 19. So a simple approach, and I understand that was also the proposal of Fei Long, was to say, well, if it's related to service, then it's short-term employee benefits. If it's something that you need to, because you have a deficit in the plan, then it's under 93. Because I was still struggling. I heard the proposal that I think it was Laurent saying that, well, let's look at risk sharing, and then the staff said you would come to the same conclusion. I don't think so, because whether you have 4% over all the years or 4% in the first years and then 6%, I think it's still the same risk sharing theme. There's no difference in the risks that is taken by the employee. So from my point of view, you would not come out with the same conclusion. And at the end of the day, if it's a percentage of your salary, you could always say, well, it's linked solely to service of this period because it's related to the salary which is paid for your service in this period, whatever the salary is, and it's simple percentage of it, whether it's 6% or 4%. So as a short-term solution, maybe we could try to widen the instances under which you could come to short-term employee benefits, but I think at the end of the day, the board needs to look at 93 again and then think whether they should change the standard, because implementation guidance really doesn't help us if the standard has the wording as it stands right now.
Sorry, Wayne, can I just...
Yes.
Just make 2 points. I guess there's been a few comments about the requirements in paragraph 93 referring to a link to service. I guess paragraph 93 applies to employee contributions related to defined benefit plans. And the reference to a link to service in the context of contributions for defined benefit plans was intended to distinguish those ones that are kind of an additional funding requirement or a sharing of the funding costs of the plan versus contributions that are required by the plan to, for example, fill up any deficits or share in the surplus of a plan, which aren't linked to service. So that reference under 93 was more meant to distinguish those two types of contributions in the context of defined benefit plans and contributions to those plans. The reference to the relationship to the service in the current period in the staff paper is intended to distinguish between contributions that are would be better accounted for under as a reduction in short-term benefits versus within the scope of the requirements for defined benefit plans. So I think there's a bit of a subtle distinction there that we're trying to make, and perhaps that could be borne out in terms of the any implementation guidance or how the committee would want to proceed. But I just wanted to make that distinction there. The second point I wanted to make was in reference to the comments I made earlier when I mentioned that Laurence's suggestion about the risk sharing was not inconsistent with what was in the staff paper. I think that still holds. I don't think that risk sharing is the only circumstance where the accounting under paragraph 93, where you attribute the contributions in accordance with the attribution requirements of defined benefit plans, would be the only case. There would be the case for the shared funding as well. For instance, where you have the different percentages of contributions depending on the past service requirements, for instance. So I just wanted to make those two comments.
Andrew?
Well, I agree with the comments that the staff paper is perhaps a bold but helpful reading of the paragraphs. And in terms of the way forward, this is the standard's now live, and I don't know, I can't recall what the due process is for implementation guidance, but I mean, it's likely to be a quicker answer than anything else. So before we throw that out, I think we should just pause the thought on that point.
Excuse me, Kazu, you wanted to come in?
Yeah. I just wanted to mention, when we say we refer to the board for reconsideration, I'm just wondering what basis we should refer to the board, because as a previous meeting, we agree that board's intention has been consistent with developing paragraph 93, and the committee agreed generally what the intention is and what the requirements are. So, In my mind, you know, amending the standard is not choice, but implementation guidance or interpretation will be the only way to go.
Okay. I offered board members a chance to speak in relation, I think, to Scott's observation that it's hard to see how the board would have gone to reached the interpretation that we have here in the context of the guidance on short and long-term benefits. Any comments?
I wasn't around.
Patricia?
I don't think I was around when this was debated either, but I tend to agree with Scott. I mean, when I read this paper, I had difficulty getting from paragraph 93 to getting to the short-term and long-term benefit notion. But I assumed that I was missing something, which is entirely possible because it's a very difficult subject. So, I think the problem is that where it's a very simple plan and a flat percentage, people don't want to have to go through the exercise that paragraph 93 seems to be telling them to do. But isn't that really a question of materiality? I mean, if going through that exercise wouldn't give you a materially different result, then you don't have to go through that exercise. If it does give you a materially different result, then you have to go through that exercise.
I guess, Patricia, I would have assumed that it would give you a materially different result because it's a full-on present value attribution method as opposed to just a simple cash, effectively cash basis.
We looked at examples that had a payout in 5 years or something like that, and in some cases that the difference was small, but but if you play this out for a lifetime of benefit payments, I kind of ran some short-term, some, you know, shorthand numbers. It's almost always going to turn out to be
material,
really significant in terms of the calculations.
It's hard to see how a benefit that vests meets the definition of a short-term.
That, yeah, can you repeat that for the?
It's the definition of the short-term benefit in 19, which is one, I think it's one that's earned within the next 12 months. And if this contribution is subject to the vesting requirements of 19,
that's a good point.
I don't see how it is earned within the next 12 months.
I was coming to exactly the same question. Isn't the definition of a short-term benefit one that is paid?
Settled.
Settled.
Settled, yeah. Within the next 12
settled.
Months.
Settled. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. And I don't see if it's subject to vesting and going to be paid.
I don't think that's inconsistent because the question is if the gross salary is $50,000 and part of that, the $2,000 is being contributed to the defined benefit plan, is the short-term benefit the $50,000 or the $48,000, which is the amount that's paid?
That's right. I think, Pat, your description actually makes the staff's answer a little easier to take in both examples 1 and 2 if you wanted to get to a short-term answer, because if the salary is 100 and 4% goes into the plan, only 96 is actually earned in the 12 months, because in order to get the other 4, they're going to have to keep working. Now, of course, the problem with that is that it would change if they keep working when they're already vested, and that would create even more complications if we relied on that as the reason. I will also point out that as probably one of the only people who has ever actually contributed to a defined benefit plan as an employee, the way that particular plan worked, if I left before vesting, I got my contributions back. So if we relied on vesting, then we'd actually have to look at each plan and try to figure out what it has. I think for some reason in the U.S., if you have employee contributions to a defined benefit plan other than one that's part of a union contract, you have to be able to get back your contributions if you leave.
Ross?
It's because all of these concerns that have been expressed of tying it with the salary and so on that I was trying to find a solution getting to the same outcome. And I think that maybe you have the answer in your paper looking at paragraph 32. Because as one said, really the issue is when do you have to apply the project unit credit method to those employees' contribution versus accounting for them, say, on a cash basis. And you have the answer in your paragraph 32 at the beginning of your paragraph 32, saying, in other words, the contributions that are required to be attributed to period of services negative benefit in accordance with paragraph 93 are the ones that are not linked solely to the employee's service rendered in the same period. And I would stop there. Full stop. And this would provide a clarification of paragraph 93. And we would no longer be in an amendment situation. It would be effectively implementation guidance, which we could issue rather quickly. And I think that if you just stop there, then that would help addressing the issue.
Let me ask the staff a question. I'm still struggling with the first question I asked. I like the direction Laurence is going. I see how it works. But it seems to me that inherent in the whole thought process around 19 is that if you have something that escalates over years of service, it cannot be said to be attributable to individual years. It has to be looked at as a package, and then it gets you into 93. So, and I think that was why I reacted the way I did when Kaz said, oh, and I get defined contribution accounting. I don't think you do if you have any kind of an escalating, or I suppose de-escalating formula. And Manuel, you're shaking your head yes. So you're agreeing with that?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So I think to just drive the point home, even if we wanted to take just that first part of the sentence that Laurence mentions, we'd have to then also say, oh, and by the way, if you have this situation, don't go there.
I would phrase it differently.
Yeah, I'll get to the point.
As the staff mentioned it, in situation where you identify that employees' contributions are for compensation of some risk-sharing elements in the plan or for shared funding, then paragraph 93 applies, which, in other words, shows that it's not just employee service. It's not the contributions are not just for the employee service rendered in the period.
Yeah. Somebody was on the phone wanting to come in.
Yes, it's Megiddo. Listening to the discussion that we had, it seems to me that there are different ways to interpret this contribution. It's either part of short-term, and it would then fit into the definition of short-term employee benefits as IS 19 is written now in paragraph 8. It might also fit into 93, though from my point of view, the standard is not clear on whether contributions that are made in a specific year are related to the service of this period. And again, I could simply say, even if I have an escalating escalating percentage of my salary, I could still say, well, it's part of the salary that I'm earning in this period, so it's related to the service that I'm providing in this period. So I think, and maybe I have to clarify that to Manuel and the staff before, I'm sympathetic with what the staff tries to do here, because I think this very complex calculation is really a burden for preparers. So maybe a way to go is say, well, the standard is not clear when it comes to contributions that are related to service. It might be short-term employee benefits. It might be part of the defined benefit contributions of a pension plan. And I think at the end of the day, the only one who can resolve this is the board to look at it again. I'm still struggling. I don't know whether I understood Laurence's proposal correctly. It seems to me that she proposed that she said, well, if it's related to funding a deficit in the plan, which is then risk sharing, then it's 93. But if it's related to service, it's not 93. I would be very sympathetic to that. And I think that the standard, as I said, is not clear on how to account for those contributions that are not risk-sharing, i.e. funding a deficit in the plan. So maybe the way forward is that we say we think the standard is not clear on those kinds of contributions. It might be short-term employee benefits if it's settled within 12 months. It might be part of the defined benefit contribution. And as the standard is not clear, we need to clarify the standard by an amendment of the standard. I think implementation guidance will not help us here because the standard is not clear. But at the end of the day, if we cannot come up with this conclusion, I would then say, well, let's go for the implementation guidance. It's better than nothing.
Guido, I guess the reservation that occurs to me is that everything about a pension plan is related to years of service. Employer contributions, all of our attribution computations, and the attempt here is to, as is the attempt in the short-term benefits section, which isn't great standard setting in my view, is to say there's a subset that gets effectively cash basis accounting. And that subset is defined not in terms of the type of benefit, but the period of settlement, which also makes it kind of tough for an American to follow. I hear some people saying that they don't think that you can get to the implementation guidance on its own. And that if you want the answer that's proposed for the implementation guidance, then there has to be an amendment to the standard. Can I have a show of hands of people who take that view? Even without the phone, I think a majority of the committee clearly believes that we can't do this with the implementation guidance alone. So then I come back to Kazu's question, which I'm going to put Scott because he's got his light flashing. What exactly are we going to ask the board to do in terms of an amendment?
That's not why I pressed my button. Sure. I would think that what we need is either sentences or an A paragraph to insert around paragraphs 92 and 93. But that is kind of thinking off the top of my head.
Would it be more of an exception to the general rule of 93?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think we have to see how we can write it, right? Right now, 93 says, and maybe we need to change the sentence, 93 says, contributions from employees or third parties in respect of service are attributed to periods of service as a negative benefit in accordance with paragraph 70. I mean, yeah, it seems like it'd be an exception to that, except when,
yeah,
you know, that they are solely with reference to current year service, I mean, whatever the language is. It seems like it's a sentence or two there. And then the implementation guidance, kind of like we've been talking about here, that would explain, you know, this is what paragraph 93 means.
Okay. Joanna and then Laurence.
Sorry, I was just going to add, in terms of what we need to amend, I'm wondering whether actually the definition of short-term benefit is a problem, because if you actually look at that definition, in terms of the settlement, so whether in fact there needs to be an amendment there, because I actually think that that is almost the root cause of the problem with 93.
I don't know the answer, but
it actually, I mean, you look at that and you say, if you use that as your first thing and say, do I have it, what is my short-term benefit, you get your answer, and the rest surely then has to fit into...
In my experience, tweaking definitions within IS-19 is non-trivial.
Agree, but I actually think that if you literally read that definition, we've got a problem.
Sandy, just let me turn your mic on.
Yeah, I look at that definition and have exactly the same thing. As the conversation has progressed, you've convinced me that everything is not short term because it's not settled.
Or the bit that is settled is short-term and the rest ain't.
Yeah, right,
but
that's very small.
That would mean that employee contributions should be taken as a reduction of service.
Yes.
All of them.
All of them.
Not just the simple ones.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. All of them.
As long as they aren't vested immediately.
Yes.
But, of course, the example that I had, you're always vested in your employee contribution. Yeah. So you'd actually get different answers based on what the plan says.
Right. You're always vested in them. Well, that's my point.
I guess I would have gotten to exactly the opposite answer. Well, I'm not on the vested ones. Those are easy. But I would have gotten to the answer that they're never.
See, on the non-vested ones, I would have said that the employee contributions are not paid out based only on the current salary, you have to work, or on the current service, you have to work more years to get it. Therefore, the short-term benefit is the net of your salary and the required employee contribution. So the employee contribution does reduce the short-term employee benefit. In essence, your salary is only 96, not 100.
In every circumstance, it's just the salary, the bit that is settled, that is your short-term benefit.
Well, then
everything else...
Right. That would mean that even in the simple plans, even in the complex plans, the employee contribution would reduce short-term benefits as long as it wasn't vested. And if it was vested, then the employee contribution wouldn't reduce short-term benefits even in the simple plans.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'd have a very different line. The question would be whether you are immediately vested in your short-term benefit or not.
So then, do I or don't I? I'm being stupid today for some reason. Get cash basis accounting for the four.
I think I have to attribute the four as in
93.
If you were going to do it based on that definition, if we think that that definition says the difference is whether it's vested or not, you get, if the salary is 100 and the contribution is 4, your short-term employee benefit is 100 if the contribution is vested, and 96 if it's not.
Yeah. End of story.
But I'm not sure that is the end of story.
Because once it's not a short-term contribution, then it's subject to the attribution requirements of
all of this. So the short-term benefit is 100 or 96. If the short-term benefit is 100, because the contribution is vested, then you're done. If the short-term benefit is 96, then I think you got to do the attribution again. Or did I get it backwards?
No, I think you just agreed with me, and that's what I was trying to figure out, is whether we were actually disagreeing or not. You're saying that the short-term benefit is 96 in your example.
If the contribution is unvested.
If the contribution is unvested, and that therefore the 4...
Goes into the negative benefit contribution.
Goes into the negative benefit and has to go all the way through the attribution.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
On the other hand, if the contribution is immediately vested, then it doesn't matter how it's calculated, it doesn't matter what it's based on, because it's vested, it's a short-term benefit, and you don't have to go through all the rest of the computations.
Okay, Laurence, and then I'm going to go to the phones.
Sorry. Question. In this situation, does it matter whether the salary is not net settled?
hope not, but I'm confused by all.
No, but so, it's, I'm just concerned. I'm just concerned that going into that direction would complicate the matter. And so this is why, I mean, I think it's much easier to see these employees' contributions generally as a reduction of the plan's costs, as a negative benefit. And so this is why I much prefer the route that has been looked at to amend somehow the last sentence of paragraph 93 to really capture those situations where the board had in mind that the projected unit credit method should apply to those employees' contributions. That is when there is a risk-sharing element from the part of the employee as part of the contributions. And I think that it's much simpler, easier to understand. The contributions relate to the cost of the plan. We wouldn't get into those complex things about assessing short-term, doing the mechanics of saying, okay, it's short-term benefit, salary, and so on, linking it to salary. I much prefer it to link it to the cost of the plan as a negative benefit. And just clarifying, if we go to the IESB, it's that last sentence that is confusing and seems prescriptive and not allowing any analysis of circumstances. So I would rather go into that direction than in the short-term benefits direction.
Well, let me ask the staff a question. If the plan itself is a defined contribution plan, then we don't care. Yes, you agree or no, we don't
care. I agree.
Okay.
We don't care.
So if the plan itself is defined contribution, we don't care. The existence of a risk-sharing mechanism, as Laurence defined, makes it defined benefit. So we're already there. So I think what Laurence would like to do is already operational in the distinction. Once there's a risk-sharing mechanism, it's a defined benefit plan. Then there are two approaches on the table, and I'd like to see hands for each, provided I describe them accurately. Approach one is the approach captured in the implementation guidance, which may or may not require an amendment, but says there is a subset of these things that get cash basis accounting of these employee contributions. The other approach is to say, no, the only thing that qualifies as short term is the net salary. And so the employee contribution piece always has to go through the full attribution method. Let's ignore whether or not we can accomplish either of those without an amendment and just say which we prefer is the answer, and then we'll work toward it. So one is some of them get cash basis accounting and we've got to draw a line. The other is none of them get cash basis accounting. Employee contributions always, if they're in a defined benefit plan, always have to go through 93 attribution. So can I have a show of hands as between some or none, which we prefer? For some? Okay. That's a majority of the table, and I suspect would be, but let's go to the phones anyway. Luca?
Yes, I agree.
With which? Some or none?
Sorry?
No. Our choices were the approach in the paper in which some of these things get cash basis accounting, or the approach that seems to be suggested by the standard, which is that none of them get cash basis accounting. Those are your two choices.
I would say some.
Okay.
Some.
Fei Long?
I prefer some too.
Okay, Guido?
Add me to that list.
Okay, that's a very large majority. Now the question is, can we accomplish this through implementation guidance, or do we have to go back to the board and say, oh, by the way, you need to create an exception? And I guess let's just, we've talked around that. How many people believe that we cannot accomplish this without an amendment? Okay. That's a majority at the table. Let's go to the phones. The question is, do we need to ask the board for an amendment? Luca?
Yes, I think.
Peggy? Peggy, I thought I heard a yes, but it wasn't clear. Can you say again?
I would agree.
Fei Long?
I agree.
And Guido?
I agree that we need to have an amendment in the standard to clarify it, but as a short-term solution, if the board cannot react quickly enough, I think implementation guidance would help, because as I said before, I think the standard is not clear, and I'm not sure about the status of implementation guidance, if the standard is clear, but it's really about the new IS-19 is applicable from this year on, so I hope that the amendment of the board will be there as soon as possible. So I agree, generally we need an amendment, but as a short-term solution, it might help to have something to help the preparers. It doesn't have to be an implementation guidance. Maybe it's something that we could deal with in the rejection notice.
Okay, my sense of the committee is that first, obviously, there's support for the idea in the staff paper, but there's a large majority that says the only way you can get to that idea is to create an exception, probably in paragraph 93 of the standard. I'm also going to suggest to the committee that because this is a live standard and we're talking about something that needs to be done fairly quickly, this is not an annual improvement. We need to take this to the board on its own bottom. Do I see any objections to that? Okay, then we'll instruct the staff to take this to the board as quickly as we can, as close to a one-line amendment as we can get it, 293. Scott?
I just want to confirm this means we're going with the paragraph 93 route rather than the change the definition of short-term benefit route. Is that,
yeah,
is that correct? Okay.
I take Manuel's point that that's a prior pass.
Perfect.
Okay.